Micronics boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. So to learn from the best, head over to micronicstraining.com. Welcome to the Packet Pushers Weekly Show, your deep dive introduction into all things networking. This is part two of a show that we recorded with Ryan Harden, Tim Raphael, and John Anderson, nerds in the hot aisle of higher education. These guys are bending modern networking tools to their will, and we pick up the conversation where we left off in part one. Now we are headed down the road of automation.
Whenever we talk about whether it's automation tools or Python scripting and the things that you can do with Python, a lot of people are very interested in that. Those shows do very well. Are you guys doing anything with those sorts of tools? We could say Python, but let's start with Ansible, Salt, those what I would call state enforcement tools, where you want the network or a piece of equipment to reflect a certain state, and you use that tool to push that state into that device.
So we are a little bit, we aren't using Ansible or Salt or anything like that yet, but we're looking into those, and it's something that I want to get us moving towards as soon as possible, just because, like I said, we have 175 buildings. Each one of those have, you know, somewhere between 7 and 10 access switches, and then, I mean, that becomes a lot of devices to take care of manually. But what we're doing now is, I mean, at the really high layer, we use Infoblox, and we're using Infoblox and NMRI to push things like access list changes, because logging into every device and saying no IP access list, blah, and then repasting in the new access list just takes somebody way too long. If we can let a script do that or let NMRI do that, that's a lot better. But so in that sense, I think a lot of people have those either a package tool or a homegrown tool where they do something like that. Even if it's just to update, you know, passwords on the devices or something like that, that side of automation exists almost everywhere. But in terms of, you know, making actual network configuration changes that require some kind of logic, I think it's still kind of in a primitive form. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that, but that's the perspective I have at the moment.
We're doing that. We're doing it with Ansible and some Python. We're fortunate in that we are a Juniper shop, and so we have a good bit of automation built into the platform itself, or at least the foundation of it. But to your point about logic within config pushing, that's not as hard as it seems. So one of the things that we do is we are a brownfield when it comes to automation, but one of the things we can do is determine state on the fly. And that, I think, is really important. So the use case I had written down in the notes was when we were doing edge port security and doing MAC limiting, being that we're a university environment, you know, you might have different MAC limits on different ports across campus. How do you automate that enforcement when you're deploying that for the first time? And so being able to pull that config down on the fly, making a decision on a per port basis is definitely something that you can do with Ansible, at least. And of course, you could do that programmatically with Python very easily. But the barrier to entry there is not as high as a lot of people think. And my tip is just start with something small and then move forward. It's all about iteration.
Mm. Start with something common that you can use as a tool to not only train yourself, but train everyone else around the way in which you might scale that up to something more prevalent. Yes.
Pick something small, but something you do frequently. One of the biggest pitfalls I see people do is they pick some low-hanging fruit, like maybe moving ports in their data center when they have a relatively small data center, and they don't actually move ports that often. So you've written this beautiful automation in an afternoon that you can move a server to a different port in your data center, but you only ever do that once every 3 or 4 months. And so in that 3 or 4 months, something's changed, something's broken, and you wind up spending 20, 30 minutes troubleshooting your automation when you could have just done it by hand.
And that's where a vendor platform comes in. This is where SDN automation, SDN-style automation or orchestration solutions work, because there's somebody spending all that time keeping that scripts up to date or the orchestration system up to date.
Something like VLAN changes on ports. That's a bit more.
That's useful. Where everyone seems to start.
Now, I think, and the example of that, of course, is your bash scripts with SNMP. You know, you turn on enhanced monitoring on an interface for X days until you get what you need.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
The interesting use case that I had to start getting some automation into a network I was working for, customers would have an Ethernet. This is a service provider environment, so customers would have an Ethernet service. And I was level 2, level 3 support, and I'd have the operations guys come to me and say, oh, so-and-so customer hasn't got a connection. And I'd run the same half dozen commands every single time on the edge routers to figure out what was wrong with that connection. And it turned out that you could turn this into a decision tree pretty easily. If there's no MAC addresses, okay, there's something wrong between me and the customer, so let's look at provider. If there's no ARP, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So once you model that process into some code, in my case it was Python. Again, talking to Juniper makes it really easy. You have lovely standard calls that you can make to grab MAC tables, ARP tables, BGP peer status, and all that jazz.
And the PyEZ kit that they provide.
Yeah, as well. Precisely.
Exactly. And that's actually what Ansible's built on. The built-in modules are built on that framework.
Yeah. So we're able to turn that into something that I could give to the operations center guys and say, okay, here we go. If a customer rings up with Ethernet problems, run this. It'll spit out one of 8 diagnoses. The 9th being, come and see me because something is really screwy. And it hardly ever got that far. So they were raising tickets with providers and getting customers to do as the instructions said. So ARP entries missing, right, customer's got wrong IP address, or can't ping from beyond the gateway, customer's got default gateway wrong. All those kind of things were solved because it's a common use case. The one thing I found with that is, again, brownfield. So you need information. You need a decent source of truth, which is becoming an interesting trend for people to, I mean, CMDBs have been around for ages, but not with the information that is useful to us to write this sort of automation. I find that is a really key place to start. Get some information about what's connected where, even if you generate it through a script, that will allow you to then leverage that information to do something useful.
I think that's probably the issue with us and probably a lot of people is that, you know, it's easy to say, well, just pick a low-hanging fruit or pick something that's easy that you do relatively often and write something around it. But it's easy to get down this rabbit hole of, okay, well, if I want to do that, then I need to be able to create this. And if I create this, then I need to be able to think about what might it look like if I want to change it in this other way. And getting back to that, you know, an accurate data for the source of truth is, you know, all of a sudden you're writing this big, massive database and you haven't written any usable code that actually solves anyone's problems yet. And the tough part is that if your networking team is flush with developers or people that can write code, and by that I mean not me, then that's relatively easy because you can find somebody say, hey, you know, for the next 6 months, I want to start working on this. Can you start tinkering around with ways of capturing all this data and putting it into something that we can query? But if you don't have somebody like that, it's really hard to get started with some of those tools because if you slap Ansible down in front of your kind of normal network engineer, they're going to be like, it's going to take me a lot longer.
What do I do with this?
Exactly. And they're going to be like, why can't I just log into the switch and make the change myself? That's 10 times faster than figuring this thing out.
Exactly.
So I think that's the other, you know, big barrier to entry is that it's not just something at least, and that's what I meant kind of by it being in somewhat primitive form, is that it's not as it's not something you can just sit down in front of your network engineers, especially your more junior network engineers, and say, this is how we do things now. It's going to take a lot longer to get them on board, or not necessarily on board, but up to speed on how to use that. I mean, even if they're, you know, ready and willing, it's not something you can just say, okay, tomorrow we're using this.
Well, this is what I found, is you find one very, very small use case. And in my case, I just wanted to query the MAC addresses on a customer's interface. The one thing I really needed was the customer's ID mapped to some VLAN ID. That would then tell me the location, the device, the interface, and the the service provider and the VLAN ID. And once I had that information, I could generate. So I was lucky I had an operations manager at the time that was happy for me to spend some time on making sure that I had that data. And yes, I wrote some scripts to pull it out and that kind of stuff. But once I had that, we were able to demonstrate, look, this is something really cool we can do. And the network manager at the time has taken that and completely run with it now. And they're doing some very cool stuff in terms of enabling their first frontline support to respond to customer queries really quickly. And yes, they've had to tell them, look, we're not logging into devices anymore. We've got these scripts, these endpoints, these web interfaces to go and do stuff. You've just got to find the easiest thing you can start with. And it might not seem impressive to you, but to someone who's never used an Ansible playbook before, just being able to hit one command line action and see it go off and touch three devices, that's impressive.
Yeah, definitely. So I brought up that use case of port security. The only reason we were able to do that, short of actually deploying NAC, which of course no one actually ever does.
the myth, the legend, network access control.
But the only reason we were ever able to deploy anything like that is because of this type of automation. Because there's no way you can tell an engineer, hey, for the next 6 months, you're going to sit down and put port security on 15,000 switch ports. Have fun.
No, thanks.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen. But when you do your automation correctly, you can do that in 10 minutes. Mm. But to go back to the source of truth, an argument I get into with a lot of people is over whether or not you need a comprehensive source of truth or a source of truth that's only good enough for what you're automating. And the answer is definitely that you only need a source of truth for what you're automating. So you don't need a source of truth that has all of your like authentication parameters. Like that's the same across every switch. You can put that one place, it doesn't matter. And you don't need a single source of truth either. You can have a distributed source of truth. So whether you've got a whole bunch of stuff in SolarWinds, God help you, you can use that. And if you've got InfoBlox for IPAM management, you can go there for your IPAM. It doesn't have to be in one database. And so if you want to automate your VLANs, maybe you need to build a database for VLANs across all of your buildings. But you don't need to build out your entire device config in this object or in a database to be able to automate just your VLANs. You just need that.
Now we're wading into sort of the glue code / middleware sort of discussion where you start building code that wraps your business use cases and workflows, and it then pulls from sources of truth sitting around that, I guess. So mm-hmm. Yes, you go to InfoBlox for your IPs and VLANs. You go to your CRM or your some database for office to switch port mappings or all that kind of thing to pull that information in. And yeah, you have to be prepared to pull information from multiple places and don't duplicate it. Don't duplicate information no matter what you do.
Right.
If there's something that exposes it, good enough. Make it work.
Mm-hmm.
We're really talking about a roll your own kind of a solution, but yet there's entrants, some of whom have been Packet Pusher sponsors that have talked about their own solutions that'll help you with this. So you mentioned glue in the generic sense, you know, glue sticking things together, mm-hmm. glue code, but there's also Glue Networks, the company who would allow you to build Lego blocks of code that you can assemble into a configuration and push out in a modular sense.
This is a perfect example of a platform that would suit perfectly this. It allows someone who's not necessarily strictly a programmer to build up that business use case and find those automation workflows that work for them. So yeah, they've got a perfect name in that regard.
Right. And where do you draw the line between doing it yourself and deciding, okay, I need a vendor tool that's going to help me with this?
It depends. Yeah.
For us, it came down to funding.
Yeah, so that's the other thing.
It goes back to what we talked about before. Is there a fancy 800 number attached to it that we can call if something isn't working right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got a good team that is used to developing and you've got a build before buy mentality, then you're probably more likely to build something. If you've got either a more green team or you've got people that tend to know, buy from the big vendors, you're more likely to buy, of course. I mean, hopefully, I think the best world is somewhere in between, because, you know, if there's vendors out there that have a solution that do 80% of what you want and you have to write the other 20%, well, I think that's better than picking a vendor solution that only does 80% and then just ignoring that other 20.
Right. Well, I think it also comes back to starting small. So for me, like I said, it was a lack of funding, but we just picked something small that made our lives easier. And then just this iteration, we got more and more and more, and then we got to a point where we could do it all in-house, but you don't necessarily have to. So if automation is an initiative, then I would say, yeah, go look at a third-party vendor. But if you're just looking to make your life easier in general, then maybe you can roll your own.
And I guess in the process of rolling your own as well, it's a process of discovery as well for what works for you, what you might need, what you might not need.
Oh, yes.
And some vendor solutions would give you those things and some might not.
Yeah, that you need to know what you're going to buy. This is what I always say to people is, and they say, well, what management system should I buy? I said, well, what do you know about management? They go, well, we've only ever used the CLI in 30 years of network operations, right? And the thing is that it's quite often it's cheap. It's best to go out and buy a cheaper off-the-shelf network management solution and then realize what's missing and then iterate forward very fast. So I've often said to people, go and buy, you know, one of the low-cost networking solutions from a company like SolarWinds or Paceler or, you know, those types of companies. Put it in and then quickly realize how limited in scope those products are and the sorts of features that you need to get in a platform. And now you're equipped, educated, skilled. You understand the principles behind network management, the sort of things that you... And now you're ready to buy the big spend on the networking platform. You need to know what you're buying. You need to have... you need to know what the hooks and the problems are and not buy too much, but you also need to know how much you need and what those things are, and you won't know them. Like the first time you ever buy a car, how many times have you ever heard the story of people getting ripped off with the first car they bought when they got their license at 18 or whatever the legal age is in your local jurisdiction? You know, and the stories are legend. You know, you bought a lemon with your first car, but you know, that's the nature of it. You have to know what you're buying. And how do you do that? Automation, writing scripts is a great way to discover these are the levers. This is what the engine looks like. This is what good tires look like. I need a radio in the dashboard. But what's the difference between a radio and a good radio? Blah, blah, blah. Same thing applies exactly to network automation.
Because there's the overhead in trying out vendor A and sinking 2 or 3 or 4 days at a minimum into, okay, what does this do and does it work for me? Does this feel right? Does this suit my business processes? No, move on to vendor B, rinse and repeat until you find something that fits. And I guess that depends on scale. So in the previous businesses I've tend to work in, the scale has been relatively small. So we've been able to look at vendor A, try it out for a few days, doesn't really work. It's missing this, isn't this, throw it out, move on to the next one. But I guess at a larger scale, you do a more standardized proof of concept. And it all comes down to budget as well. So how many man hours can I sink into a proof of concept on vendor A and vendor B? It all depends. Yeah.
I think that really is challenging for especially those of us that have large campuses is that, you know, I mean, I've got five different vendor switches and routers in my network. So I can't, it's not a very simple proof of concept to put, you know, if I wanted to fire up Ansible, yeah, I can make it work against Cisco or I can make it work against Juniper, but can I make it work against all of the vendors that I have in various different aspects of my network? And how do I actually test that in a way that's not extremely time consuming, especially when we're going from something, you know, from not having anything, and there's nothing really to compare it against. So it's just, I think what you're saying is 100% true. You know, smaller environments are a lot easier to do this. I mean, I think it's kind of an obvious statement there, but in these mixed vendor environments, it gets really tricky for, just to go from no automation to even a little bit of automation.
Well, I think at that point we've got to look back to the standards bodies to come to full flesh things like OpenConfig and the Yang models. They're there, but they're not there yet. But I hope that we can get to that point because that's exactly what you're talking about. Just creating an abstracted model for networking, like Ethan was talking about, both on design and the config side, so that we can put any vendor we want, we can mix them all together, and we can automate the whole thing, and it doesn't matter.
So I think the tricky part with that, and I'll just state that I agree with you, is that how do we make that in the best interest of the vendor, right? Because they sell their own management tools. So why would they make it so you can write your own or use somebody else's tools when
they want to sell you theirs? They're going to scream differentiation. They're always going to scream that. Well, we don't want this common baseline of config because we're different and we're special and we have magical things inside. If you look very closely, there's little unicorns that carry the packets from this part of the ASIC to the other. And unless you use our special thing, you know, we can't roll that into the standard configuration. And oh gosh, that'd be terrible. And so it's up to the customers to like OpenConfig, you know, insist that we want this common way to be able to configure devices that is vendor agnostic and support that, which gives us the opportunity to roll our own or use a solid third-party tool and have a baseline of functionality across all of the vendor devices. And then see where that goes. I mean, the danger, what I fear there is what happened with SNMP, where, yes, there's the MIB2 part of the tree, and yes, everybody supports it. But all the interesting things are under enterprise private, and then you start getting into...
I was just about to make that point, and I was going to say it's kind of scary that we're in this point where we know we want these abstracted models, but the OpenConfig and the Yang models aren't there yet. So we've got companies like Glueware and the other guys that are building their own models. And that's kind of scary because we're going down that road that we went down with SNMP, and that didn't work.
Well, they're building their own models, not just because of hardware and the fact that accessing that hardware is different, but also that the interfaces are different. So you look at Anuta Networks to pick on another vendor. It's they'll support whether all they got is screen scraping and expect scripts and you know, a command line interface. They can do that, or they can do SNMP, or they can do NetConf. Not because they want to, but because they have to, and so they'll abstract away whatever the southbound interface that might be available, which sucks. It's hard for vendors to build these products. And it ends up that the products that they build end up being very, whoever the customer is that's got their attention is who's getting the next feature. And so rather than having a great tool that you can use out of the box, it's, well, as this product gets better and better and more features, it supports a broader array of equipment that's out there. And eventually it'll align with what I've got and then I can use it. It's a terrible place to be for networking. Yes, all the standards totally we have that are not standards.
So are we destined to be stuck in this middle ground where we have to have abstracted southbound APIs just to have anything even remotely quote-unquote standard, where we're going to have a mix of interfaces? We're never going to get... I mean, it's going to be a unicorn where OpenConfig is applied across everything and everything supports Yang and it's all lovely and beautiful and everyone's happy.
But the abstraction layers aren't just... that's not just software, though. It's hardware, too, right? You've got the switch abstraction interface to cover different kinds of silicon. You know, is our abstraction interfaces making our lives better or just scaring us all?
Well, look at the complexity that's added when you have to have a platform like Open Daylight or something like that has to have SNMP, RESTConf, NetConf, Expect, Yang over NetConf, etc., to push configs down into all the devices it supports. You can create abstraction layers, but...
You're relying on the software engineering behind that abstraction layer to accurately abstract what you want to do and to still give you the interfaces that you want, so you have the functionality out of that Southbound interface that you need.
Correct. But the thing is, with abstraction, two things happen. One, you gain simplicity. Two, you gain complexity. Hmm. If your simplicity doesn't outweigh the complexity you add, you end up with technical debt. And you end up with limitations and all these other things that can cause you pain in the future.
And just to add to what Ethan said is and to have the trust in the vendor to that when they send a new version of code out there that it can handle the fact that the vendor A switched the column order on show output. And now instead of getting, you know, the interfaces up, you're getting the interfaces down because the column order is incorrect or something like that.
Exactly. Trivial as that.
Exactly. I mean, things that, you know, your eyes can figure that out because when you type show interface, whatever, you know, you can determine that, oh, that used to say up. Now it says 14. Oh, well, I want to look over here. Oh yeah, the interface is up. Well, your expect script doesn't understand that. So
a problem that hopefully goes away as we get to structured data coming out of API calls more and more. Which isn't to say vendors can't change the structured data that they hand back from an API call from version to version, but hopefully we don't have too much of that.
Well, the idea behind NetConf, I might put a link in the show notes. There's a very good white paper from Taylor F. Taylor F is now a Cisco company that talks about how, like in detail about the concept behind NetConf. And what the IETF is actually working on is that when you make a NetConf request, the device can tell you it's self-modeling. That is, when you make an API request, the NetConf will tell you what parts of the API it services and what data models it supports so that you can adapt them over time. And you can iterate through the NetConf configuration. So the data that's available in your NetConf data structure can change over time. That's really important. That's what part of the reason the IETF is moving so slowly on NetConf is because they want to get these, what they call self-defined models, which is really a chicken and the egg.
It's similar to the NetFlow version 9 templates and I guess primitively to SNMP OIDs where the device can tell you what metrics it supports and there's some sort of central mapping. But I think you're still going to have vendors that have features that aren't, I mean, they can be self-describing, but that doesn't necessarily mean those metrics or configuration levers can be interpreted at the other end. They're all always going to have some point of differentiation.
I think as long as we have a baseline across the board, we'll be okay. And then if you want those additional features, they're there. But the problem we have today is not everybody implements the baseline.
Exactly. So even just checking interface status across five different vendors is hard enough.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We are taking a short break from the show to talk about one of today's sponsors, Micronix Training. I can talk about Micronix not just because they are a sponsor, but because I am a Micronix customer. In fact, I have attended multiple CCIE routing and switching boot camps with Micronix over the years with instructor Narbik Kacharians. One boot camp was just before I passed my CCIE routing and switching lab back in 2008, and the most recent one was in the fall of 2015. Micronix boot camps are the real deal. You get detailed workbooks that show you not only what to do, but also the most important part of networking, verifying that what you've configured is working right. You also get live lectures from top-notch instructors. For example, Narbik's lectures are legendary among those of us that have sat in them. He wastes no words while still clearly explaining topics that might have frustrated you before. And you will not see a PowerPoint. It is all whiteboard. It's sort of like being Neo in the Matrix. You leave the lecture feeling like network foo was uploaded directly to your brain. These boot camps aren't just workbooks and lecture, though. You also get time to work on equipment configuration with even more labs designed to teach specific concepts. These boot camps are, if I'm honest, really tough, because if you do everything that's expected of you, your boot camp days will be some of the longest, but most rewarding, 5 or 10 days that you can spend. Which reminds me, Micronix offers several CCIE-level boot camps, including routing and switching, security, data center, and service provider. Some of them are 5 days, some of them are 10 days, and if you're not working on a CCIE certification, Micronix offers instruction in several other courses, including CCNA, CCNP, DCICN, CCDE, and more. So to learn from the best, head over to MicronixTraining.com. Micronix is an authorized Cisco Learning Partner, and they accept Cisco Learning Credits. One more time, that's MicronixTraining.com. And please, when you sign up for a course or a boot camp, let them know that Packet Pushers sent you. We talked about automation. Are any of you doing anything that would be also SDN or you know, come under the what is now a very large umbrella term, SDN? That could be you're using a centralized platform, a centralized controller that's programming switches, or you know, fill in the blank with the other many other things that marketing has stuck under SDN. Are you using it, and do you have any comments on it?
We're doing NSX. We've got a limited deployment going now for things like PCI and some other little security areas, but we're doing
as in microsegmentation. You're using NSX specifically for microsegmentation to help you with PCI compliance.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then, and based on how well that has gone, we have already got the funding, and we're doing some testing now to convert the entire data center to an NSX platform. And as a part of that, we're going to do QFX series switches. And depending on how that goes, we're going to be doing an IP CLOS with EVPN, VXLAN, the whole work.
Oh, very nice.
It's going well. There are definitely some gotchas here and there, but it's getting there. I think the biggest problem we have today is that VMware will release a software update and it just breaks everything. And we used to not have that problem because the entire data center wasn't dependent on this tiny little thing that controls everything.
So I previously worked for a VMware cloud partner. So they run an Australian national cloud, public cloud provider service, and they'd be based out of all the main capitals. And they moved over to the NSX. They started using NSX for the networking to allow customers to do micro-segmentation within their VDCs and control their policy. And they found the same thing. As NSX was a new piece to the puzzle, a software update would break a lot of interfaces with other parts of the stack. But I think that's just a growing pains with regards to the platform. And I'm told that in later releases, it's becoming less and less often, particularly with the, I think they're up to 6.2 or forward.
It's
improving.
that's the Docker problem at the moment. Yeah, you know, like every time a new version of Docker comes out, it breaks everything. And the answer is they came out with a minimum viable product, and now everybody says, well, now you can't change it. And they're going, hang on, it's just the first generation. You can't freeze it.
NSX was also an acquisition for VMware from Nicira. So they had to take a software stack that wasn't necessarily written with them and their internals in mind. It was consuming the external.
Yes. In the same way that vCloud Director came in from the outside, and they flooded the integration of that as well. They weren't very good at bringing in, buying outside companies and bringing them in and integrating them. They haven't done a great job of that in the past.
It's technically a very difficult problem. And once they've bought a company, they want to turn it around and have it make some money for them as fast as possible. So devs are going to be under pressure and bugs will come out of that.
Well, Cisco always did that by never integrating them.
That's the easy solution, right?
Yeah, not very useful, but anymore. No. Like, it would work in years gone by, but it's not very useful now. Yeah.
Mm. I think there's an interesting point in there that might be a little bit bigger, and that's the difference between hardware and software development. Is that in hardware, you have to get it right the first time because the iteration on that development is years, and in software, that's not the case. Now, of course, the argument is that you get better software over time because of continuous deployment or iteration and whatnot. But you also get the downsides to that is that you're more frequently going to see bugs implemented in the code. Now, of course, they're supposed to be fixed, but that's not the case all the time.
So I wonder if, you know, is there going to be a shift? I mean, merchant silicon is the big thing now, but there are vendors that use FPGAs to kind of get around that. My hardware is stuck how I designed it 4 years ago. I wonder if there's going to be some of that in the future, you know, maybe like merchant FPGAs or something like that.
Well, if you look at what Barefoot's doing, that's the direction it's going in. But also Juniper's had the Trio chipset for donkey's years, and that's what that aimed to do. They can turn up features in the Trio just by pushing a Junos update. They can add EVPN to the MX line with the hardware acceleration without them having to do any type of hardware upgrade or massive firmware overhaul.
I think, so here's how it's been explained to me by people who are way smarter than me. FPGAs can do almost anything at wire speed, but it's incredibly difficult to program them. And a lot of the things that you need to, so in a normal ASIC, your packet forwarding is actually all done automatically in the silicon. But in an FPGA, you have to program every part of the IP routing, Ethernet handling, and TCAMs, and you know all that stuff has to be written by hand at a silicon level. It's a bit like writing an assembler type of language. So FPGAs can certainly do the job, but it's very expensive to develop and maintain the software, albeit the hardware gets a lot cheaper. The merchant silicon that we're seeing come out from Broadcom reduces the amount of software because a lot of the functions are just, you know, you make an API call on a Broadcom Trident 2 or a Cavium X client or a Centec, you know, or whoever it might be. There's lots of different, you know, and the hardware goes and does something with that, right? It just, you don't have to understand it. And that's the way And that ASIC design has been the cheapest way to build networking appliances for the last 30 years. I think that what we're going to see is that ASICs will continue, but Barefoot is showing that you can build ASICs in such a way that allows you to reprogram the forwarding part of the ASICs not by changing the way the ASICs operate, but by making the ASICs function at like an atomic level. So, you know, when a packet goes through a thing, there are rewriting functions. Well, what if I gave you a chip that would allow you 8 rewrite steps and you could do one rewriting function at every step? And that's not how Barefoot works, but in principle, that's how it is. A bit like the way Cisco implemented parallel express forwarding 10 years ago. I think what we're going to see is advances in the silicon. Sorry, here's a better analogy. GPUs. GPUs are much better at doing graphics rendering and primitives around mathematics than a general purpose Intel CPU. And so now we have computers where the GPU has far greater processing power than the Intel CPU. And so we have both of them. And now we're talking about the next generation of Intel servers will now have a GPU, an FPGA, and an Intel CPU. And I suspect that we're going to see many more appliances come out with an ASIC and some sort of FPGA that allow you to do things in ASICs and things in FPGA for some functional things. And that's possibly the way it'll go.
So what you're telling me is we're just going to have overlays on top of overlays on top of overlays.
I think you're going to have flexibility all the way down. So today we have the flexibility in software to do whatever we like, and it takes very little time. You know, any of the software virtual switches, you can change them, and boom, you've got new functions. You know, NSX has added firewalls. You know, state ARP reduction by just doing ARP locally. Why send the ARP across the network when I can do it locally because I know every endpoint? Those types of features would normally have taken 20 years to roll out in data networking if you wanted to implement it in the hardware. But what we're now seeing is now that we've got this flexibility in software, the hardware companies are reacting, in my view, to try and make their ASICs more flexible. So Broadcom will start to iterate. XPliant is already a flexible pipeline. And now all of a sudden we can start to be more programmable in our hardware, and it'll be an arms race between the software v hardware. Instead of being utterly static like it has been for the last 25 years in IT, in networking, where the assets went from 1 gig to 10 gig to 40 gig, you know, and that's really all we ever got. And oh, and spanning tree advanced from spanning tree to rapid spanning tree to trill, and then, you know, it really comes down to a much more wider range of choices. And it's going to be very confusing because at the same time, the market's getting smaller. Now that we got public cloud, and a lot of business is going to public cloud, no question of that. And enterprise revenue is shrinking because they want cheaper products. They're saying it's not about the, instead of managing infrastructure, it's about the software on top. So if all of a sudden all of the CIOs in the world suddenly start saying, stop buying Oracle software, and then the only thing they can change is the infrastructure. If they're all focused on DevOps or PaaS or Cloud Foundry or coding and developers, the infrastructure that's underneath is going to be much less important. And they're just going to say, I don't want to know. Just make it go away. Just give me something simple, easy to use, and we'll solve it in software. And I think that's that. So there's these competing trends going on, and who knows how it's going to come out. It's a little difficult to know.
So the only problem I see there is that we've already said, and we know that software will always be faster than hardware. So if you can reprogram your hardware to a certain degree, that means that you will, but you'll do that much faster. And when you do that more faster, eventually you're going to find this idea that you can't implement in that hardware. So you're going to have to replace the hardware. Yes. And I think that just means you're going to see faster and faster hardware replacement cycles, which isn't always friendly to the enterprise.
Well, is there? So this is my question. Yes, the vendor might be enabled to move faster because the hardware they're buying or writing their operating system on top of enables them to. But will they pass that speed of feature development onto the enterprise? Because enterprises won't tend to update their switches every year. They'll do it every 3 or 4 years. And so I can't imagine the vendor having a good successful time selling that if they're churning out products every couple of years.
Everyone is on a different cycle. Mm. So there's always someone to sell to.
This is true. It depends.
And I think the cycle is going to change.
We're at the mercy of the vendors again.
I think the cycle is changing. The days of owning gear, you said 3 or 4 years. The reality is it's more like 8 to 10, something like I saw a survey come out from Dimension Data recently, and they so of the networks that they manage, 60% of enterprise IT networking assets are obsolete. They're either end of service or end of life. And most of those have 5 or more vulnerabilities, and which means the software has not been updated in 5 or more years. So
it doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
No, it doesn't surprise me, because today the way that we build it, this goes back to your point in the beginning about, you know, buy chassis switches, build tree architectures. Today it's almost impossible to upgrade the network or change the network because we have these very fragile architectures. This best practices that we have are very fragile, and if the network collapses, the blast radius is everywhere. As we move to, you know, ECMP designs, you can lose a spine switch and you probably won't even know unless you've got some monitoring, right? Mm. Whereas if you lost a core switch, there'd be like there'd be a medical emergency in the executive switch, in the executive suite, and they'd be, you know, down on you like a ton of, you know, blah 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 blah. We all know what that looks like because we've all experienced it. And I think
we've all been there. Yeah.
It seems to me that with the shift to DevOps and DevOps, there's one big thing that's coming out of DevOps that seems less and less, doesn't seem to be discussed or understood, is companies are bringing their developers back in-house. So they're ending their outsourcing agreements slowly but steadily. They're hiring the DevOps to start doing their software development in-house using this modern microservices, API-driven, blah, 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 you know, alphabetty soup of acronyms, go nuts on all of that. And that's going to change the balance of power. Infrastructure is going to be much less important to the CIO, because the CIO isn't just going to be using off-the-shelf software like Excel anymore, or Oracle, or some human resources system that everybody hates. They're going to be able to just build their own, and they're going to spend 80% of their time working with the DevOps people and the software people to get that right, and the infrastructure is just not going to be as important. It's going to get less attention, less funding, and it's got to get simpler and much more automated to be able to make that happen.
Well, that's what we're finding with the overlay situation. That's what it's enabling. If you look at Vim, NSX, for example, all you're just going to have underneath is an IP clause, or even some EVPN if you're going to be fancy about pushing stuff between clusters. But all the cool stuff, all the actual business focus and the business functionality is now done through virtual firewalls, virtual appliances, and the application talking into those components.
One firewall, one rule type stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Might have 250 firewalls, but they've only got one rule each. That's a hell of a lot easier to manage than one firewall with 250 rules.
Yes, precisely.
But that's counterintuitive too. Telling people that, they just look at you and go, that makes no sense. But that's actually true.
Well, not to beat a dead horse, but what's really interesting there is you can get the firewall policy as close to the VNIC as possible without actually putting it on the actual virtual machine. And that's really important, because that means you can apply only the rules that matter to that VM on that VNIC.
Exactly. So and NSX specifically gives you that way to stipulate your policy at a very high level, and then it is able to push it down. So all exchange hosts allow only these ports from these other hosts, and you then just push it down the stack and it applies it on the VNIC, which is
right.
Really quite impressive.
It helps a lot for scaling as well, because, you know, the traditional one giant firewall at the edge of your data center doesn't scale well when you've got hundreds of thousands of VMs. If you've got individual rules pushed to the VNIC, you don't have to have that big giant firewall anymore.
But the point here is the underlying network, irrelevant of all this functionality we've got on top, is relatively simple. As the point we've been talking about is some ubiquitous standard way of doing things, the underlying infrastructure is starting to matter less and less and less. Mm-hmm. No, but I think we've highlighted some interesting areas where I think we came up with some good points. Automation is important. Start small. Some enterprises somewhere somehow need to start putting some influence into the ITF and other standards bodies to get them heard, because there's no point us complaining unless we're going to do something about it. And
yeah, but who's going to send somebody to Chicago, Prague, and I'm not sure where the other one is, but they go Americas, Europe, Asia.
Yeah, it's really hard because, I mean, it's hard enough to get me to tell my manager that I want to go to a conference and get him to say, well, where's the business value in that for me? And I mean, honestly, and higher ed is a weird case when it comes to IT because where's the business
education
value?
IT education of staff in higher ed is impossible. Yes,
no one sees the value of IT in education. It's like, hang on a minute. Education wouldn't happen nowadays without IT. What are you talking about?
Yeah. So I think the enterprises have got to band together, but I think we're going to have issues in there and conflicting interests when it comes to business value for IT at that point. But I see that as the only way forward is the enterprises have got to band together before going.
But it's got to be at the CTO level where, for a CTO, the value of IT and all the infrastructure and personnel they are ultimately responsible for, they wouldn't exist unless it was important to the business. So it has to, there's value at that level.
And the problem is, so, even if you do get a say, it's going to take 5 years before you see any outcome.
Exactly. Let me ask you a question here about your WAN. We've talked about SD-WAN on the packet pushes a lot. Is that something that's interesting you? Like, do you see the value of these types of solutions or?
They sound great. Problem is, I'm in Australia, so the connectivity period is still expensive, and anything cheap is still crap. So a fat synchronous internet pipe will cost you about as much as a private MPLS service. I mean, that's coming down. The NBN is, the National Broadband Network over here is starting to help with some of that, but people can't really use some of these SDN WAN technologies as yet, but the idea sounds really cool. And yeah, from an enterprise perspective, where you can use policy to direct traffic over different links, is really, really cool and very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I've been pushing it for a while, but haven't been able to get any traction. I think it's one of those things where you tell your manager, hey, instead of this giant MPLS link, we can just buy a couple of commodity links. And he's like, you want to buy a commodity for WAN? You want to do what? But I think if we could actually get it in, get it implemented in a demo and then say, hey, this is better because we actually have visibility into these things. Whereas in the MPLS, the packet went across or it didn't, but that's it.
It goes into the cloud. It just disappears off, yeah.
So for us, SD-WAN, I don't think it really gains us a whole lot because we're already doing, I mean, we don't have a traditional WAN or a WAN that most people would think of is, we have our main campus, and then we have a bunch of global sites, and we have a handful of sites around our local metro area. And, we do use an MPLS service to get the local stuff back just because it's cheap and easy. But for the global sites, we get a local ISP and we do an IPsec tunnel back to a VPN concentrator on campus. And I mean, we don't have a bunch of circuits or anything that we really need to orchestrate or really have that much control over. I mean, we dump the local traffic on the local ISP. Anything that's coming back to campus comes across the IPsec tunnel. So I think SD-WAN is interesting. I'm not sure how, I mean, I haven't heard a lot of use cases in the higher ed or university application because I just don't see how they're, I'm not sure how it benefits them in most cases.
Are you guys doing VoIP yet?
Yeah, we do VoIP. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we are currently implementing that, and that is, I think, an interesting use case for SD-WAN. We have not a huge WAN, but it's fairly comprehensive. But I think being able to put that traffic on a separate link and monitor it separately, and it not be MPLS. I think there's some value there.
So it's a smart edge appliance that allows you to get some insight into the traffic and how it's moving from an offsite location back to head office end.
Yeah, we don't route by IP header anymore. We route by application payload.
Right.
And we can.
Right. And I see that. I mean, we use VoIP. I mean, on our local metro camp or locations, we do VoIP to those. But for our global sites, I mean, we don't extend our VoIP solution to India or China or, our other big places. They have local telco carriers there. So, it's just different ways to deploy certain, the same thing. But I'm not sure how many of other universities are deploying their normal campus VoIP solution to, crossed ocean locations. I mean, there's not a whole lot of, having 5-digit dialing to somebody that's in bed doesn't really help a whole lot, I guess.
It does if you want to get their voicemail.
Yeah.
I used to work for a company, and one of the biggest features that they had was you could leave a voicemail on the system in Australia, and then it would route the voicemail to the other person's inbox later on. That was like voicemail routing.
It's like email, but with your voice.
Sorry?
Oh, you have it's like email, idea. But with your voice.
Great. Yeah, but it would transfer the voicemail over the IP network.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting here looking at the red light on my IP phone, hoping it would just go off and never, ever, ever come back on again.
Well, I think that might be it for today's show. I want to thank Ryan, Tim, and John for joining us today. Thanks so much for joining us. So let's go around the audience. Why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself and where people can find you on the net? Let's start with John Anderson.
All right. So I am a network security engineer down at the College of Charleston. You can find me on the Network to Code Slack. I think that's where all of us met, but I'm at John, J-O-H-N there. And otherwise on the internet, you can find me at LampWinds, so LinkedIn, that kind of stuff. But it's been a pleasure with you guys today. Love to do it again sometime.
Right. Thanks so much for giving up your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
What about you, Ryan?
Sure. Hey, I'm Ryan Harden. My title is fancy and long. It's Research and Advanced Networking Architect at the University of Chicago. You can find me also on the Network to Code Slack. My handle is less obvious. It is A-N-C-K-E-R, Anchor, as I like to call it. I don't know. I came up with it a long time ago, and it stuck with me, so I don't have any good story behind it, but that's how you find me. You can also find me on a very uninteresting blog at www.anchor.net. I should actually write things there more often, but I never do, and that's probably true for a lot of us, but there you have it.
Problems at all. That's great. And finally, Tim Raphael.
My name's Tim. I'm a network engineer and an independent consultant. I've worked in service provider and managed service and higher ed. You can find me at timraphael.com. I blog there, and hopefully over the next few months, I'll get a few more posts up there on anything that interests me. You can find me on Twitter at timraphael215, and on the Network to Code Slack channel and GitHub with the handle Tardoe, T-A-R-D-O-E.
Yeah, and thanks very much, Tim, because you're getting up at like 4 a.m. after
that
a night
out. It's 3 a.m. after a night out, yeah.
Great. Well, it's 4 a.m. What's it, nearly 4:30 now in the morning?
It's 5 a.m. now. We've been going for
really,
a while.
Really, really, really huge thanks for giving up your time. Mr. Banks, have you got any closing thoughts or nuggets of wisdom?
Nuggets of wisdom after 2 hours of us going on and on. Yes. I always go back to we're in a transition phase, and so everybody be flexible and pay attention to what's changing and roll with it in your environments. All the skills that are coming to bear, like we were talking about automation and what's changing with SDN and so on, now goes cross-stack, so you can't just be the networking person anymore. You got to be the other stuff too. A point that we've made on the show a number of times before, but it keeps coming up as a big deal, so...
For sure. And I think the interesting part about the discussion here is that all of these people are automating. Now, that might be a self-selecting audience because they come from a group who are talking about automation, but nonetheless, if you want to look at the future, just look around you. Sometimes you don't have to look too hard to see what the future looks like. Well, as always, this has been the Packet Pushers, and thanks for listening to us today. Thank you for giving us your time. We really appreciate it. You can find not only this podcast, but many more fine, free, technical, nerdy, networking, and data networking-centric podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on the Twitters as at packetpushers, and we're hanging around on LinkedIn, Facebook. And it would be so helpful to us if you could take the time to rate us on iTunes or tell your friends about us. Maybe send them a link to a good podcast like this one. And maybe they would like to join. And of course, we're available on just about any fine podcast tool that you might like to use. And as always, remember that last and never least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.